very quickly, I can tell you something about Winston, the racism aside. Winston is quite a remarkable guy. We were at Vich University, and he told me, he told me something that he probably told me in confidence. Didn't want me to tell it over, but you should have known better than that. But he spent most of his primary school under a tree. That was where his class was, and I've made this joke 3 times, but not here, so maybe you'll chuckle at this. I've really set that up for failure. He went to school under a tree, and then in high school I just realized Arnold had a hand in it. Am I right? You were a teacher somewhere. You didn't teach him at all.
He did.
Literature.
Yes.
We'll find out tonight.
Okay. He's ironically he's very strong in mathematics, which might this might explain it, where the problem came in. So Winston comes from Bushbuck Ridge, or Bush as our villain called it. And when he was 16 years old, he enrolled as a first-year student at the Vich University in medicine at the age of 16. At the age of 16, I was still trying to make the 16 A side in my school, and it was a lot of prayer that got me to standard 9 at that stage, whilst he was enrolled as a first-year student at Vich. And then, just for fun, he did a degree in biochemistry at the University of KZN, he's been involved there in ministry for some time. The His People Church. I'm not sure if you're familiar with His People. I know you are more concerned about your people, but he was part of their ministry team. And then Ravi Zacharias picked him up, and after a while, a couple of years ago, he went to study at Oxford University, where he did an honors degree at Wycliffe Hall, for which I have still not forgiven him. And one of the guys that's coming in August, a guy called Michael Ramsden, one of the top apologists in the world, reckons that Winston is probably the best guy to have ever gone through the Oxford Center for Christian Apologetic circles, which is a massive compliment. Obviously, I haven't been there, but yeah. And then his current university, which is probably his top university, is doing his master's at a world-renowned research institution called the Northwich University, Potchefstroom. Where he's currently doing his master's degree. But he'll tell you a little bit more about his own story, but it was just amazing spending this last week with him, talking about politics and theology and myself. Just brilliant topics. Without further ado, let's welcome Winston here.
Thank you.
Thank
you. Well, very good evening to everyone. It's been a bit of a long day. Thank you. Am I audible? Okay, excellent. Good to be with you. Thank you so much for inviting me. I've heard a lot about this platform in terms of also the type of topics and the type of people that are here and the type of people that you have speaking. And it's a real privilege for me. But tonight is really special by the fact that I met, you know, my former high school teacher, Mr. Nathaniel Tumi. But I just would like to say before I begin this talk that I firmly believe that there is no such thing as, you know, a bad student, only bad teachers. And so so tonight, if you want to rate my talk, please, you need to look that way. But yeah, it's really great to be with you, to have this moment to discuss something that is incredibly a personal journey for me. In fact, you know, this topic is a topic that I haven't just thought about in a sense that, you know, just purely as an academic or intellectual exercise, or just being part of discussions, but it's actually rooted in a real story, my story of how I got to process things growing up, and some of the challenges which I faced and obstacles which I had, and just how I happened to have maneuvered and I still am over some of these things. So I will raise a whole lot more questions than I will answer, and hopefully maybe just after a little bit of some talk time, then I'll open up some time for some questions if there's anything that's not particularly clear or that you'd like us to, you know, have a further, engage in further discourse about, then I'm really happy to do that in a while. I'm not sure how long, Johan, we have till that time, till Q&A time.
We're around
10 Bista time, excellent. All right. So at around about 7, I'll stop concluding and I'll start the talk, which is 10 Bista time. Is Jesus a Messiah for Africa? I must say, my introduction to the Christian faith was actually within a context where I hadn't heard much about the Christian faith, except that there was this figure called Jesus who was associated with the church. And being, you know, somebody who was raised in a home that practiced ancestralism, which is a term I use, I guess, to outline particularly belief in, you know, roughly God, you know, the existence of a spiritual realm, which consists of both personal and impersonal forces. By personal forces, I guess I would regard the ancestors, those who died, and, you know, they become part of this realm that brings them, that is seen rather to bring them closer to God and then represent the living, especially family members, to God, and the accompanying sort of ritual ceremonies, customs that we as families would engage in, would practice, would host, whose aim, I guess, is to have a closer relationship with our ancestors, to inquire for prosperity, blessing, for protection, to lift curses, and so forth. All of those would be what I would use the term. When I use the term ancestralism, roughly just think about what I said. Other people use different terms. In fact, I guess many people today also would, from the inside, what I call inside voices, people who still practice ancestralism, maybe the term they might use is roughly the phrase our culture. This is because it's just deeply confusing. If I was to say I practice my culture, you wouldn't know exactly what I was talking about. So the word I would use is ancestralism. But I come from that background. And I must say, I really particularly loved the religion of my birth. It was something that I derived my identity from. Growing up, my father would say, this is who we are as a people. This is where we come from, you know. And if you ever stop doing these things, you would stop being an African. Which is quite interesting today. What makes you not to be African is quite different from what we grew up knowing was the African way. But something happened in my life, which, because for the sake of time, I won't have time to share, but it made me become particularly critical about the religion of my birth, and as well as the Christian faith. As I began to process the Christian faith, my upbringing, I began to have a list of questions that I started to try and process. And I guess maybe in the beginning of this talk, I'd like to bring you into that thinking space. In my mind, you know, the story about the Christian faith was about, you know, some Jewish people who had a history with their God, and they documented that history and their interaction with their God, and somewhere along the line, they received the promise of a Messiah, of a Savior of some sort, that would come many, many years later. And many, many years later, you know, somebody was born and who claimed that to be that promised Messiah. Some people believed him, some did not. And those who believed him formed these communities around him and this religion around him and so forth. And this whole story was basically believed in the West. You know, so, you know, Westerners got hold of this story, they believed it, they probably modified it somehow, and then later, many, many years later, they brought it into Africa. And in so doing, I began then to ask the question, when they brought it to Africa, did they undermine the African narrative? You know, were the stories within our own context, which by bringing this story that they bought into, this Jewish story now bought by the West into Africa, did they undermine the African narratives? And of course, now you know, it leads me to all sorts of interesting questions about that undermining. If you wouldn't mind moving to the next two slides, probably. The next slide again. So what I've entitled, Quiz Time. And these are sort of questions I began to process. Is Christianity a form of religious colonization? The basic principles of colonization, as I understood them, was you had a people who were, you know, because of their military power and because of a need that they had, perhaps saw the opportunity to undermine a certain people, take them over, conquer them, and on behalf of the conquered, begin to unilaterally define on their behalf, like I said, what truth, what knowledge, what experience actually is. And then obviously to dispossess them of, you know, their freehold interest in their land, their territory, you know, their beliefs and so forth. And begin then to say to them, this is what you should believe to be true and with knowledge and so forth. And of course, it led me to what I call the ugly side of Christian history. Because in my mind also, it was very difficult to separate at least, you know, missionary history in Africa, contemporary Africa, with actually the colonial ships, if we might call them, or colonial history, so to speak. And so I begin to think about the link between the two and find out, well, isn't, like I said, Christianity just another form of religious, you know, colonization? And most importantly, in that sense, who gave people the right to reinterpret other people's stories? So you come across somebody's story, somebody's narrative, somebody's worldview, and from your own perspective, you begin to reinterpret them. And particularly, you know, some of these questions were very, very sensitive to me, very, very, very offensive, was the whole idea that, you know, when I spoke to Christians to try and understand the Christian faith and try to then begin to understand how does the Christian faith reinterpret my experience growing up, people would say, actually, you weren't communicating with your ancestors. Your ancestors were, according to Christian theology, just demons. And I would be really offended. Maybe let me just bring you into that world a little bit. You see, as an example, I did not know my grandmother because she passed away when I was very, very young. But the way I knew her was through our ceremonies and our rituals. See, we would go into a hut and we would have the sangoma start the ceremony, you know, playing a bit of drums here and then so forth, chanting, and she would get into a trance. And then when she would get up from that trance, she would speak in a very different voice. She would have sort of different mannerisms, and people would tap me on the shoulder and say, that's your grandmother. And then she would speak directly to me, and I seemed to be her favorite. And she'd speak to me, I saw you do this, and I saw you do that. I'm so proud of you. This is what you need to do. This is how I had my relationship with my grandmother. Then when I meet these Christians and I ask them, then how do I make sense? If what you say is true, how do I make sense of my experience? And they say, well, that's not your grandmother. That was a demon. That was highly offensive to me. And these are sort of things that I struggled with. Another one that I struggled with was, why can't I worship, you know, God through my ancestors? You see, growing up, my father would teach me that actually we don't pray to our ancestors. We pray to God through them. And this was a very, very important, you know, part of our culture, because many people would say, well, you pray to your ancestors, and we would disagree very much. We'd be very offended that if somebody actually thought we prayed to somebody else but, you know, God. But we just merely said, well, we pray to God through our ancestors. Or the term ancestral worship. People would say this is sort of ancestral worship because you worship your ancestors. We'd say, no, we worship God through our ancestors. And the important thing about that was the fact that we processed it this way, that actually, maybe God has ordained different ways for people of different cultures to come to know Him and to have a relationship with Him. And perhaps this was the way in which He had ordained worship for us as Africans. That we would You see, that he had delegated responsibility and authority to the ancestors, and this is how we related, this is what our God experienced. It was through those we were close to, or closer to than God, and those who would represent us. And so when people said, you can't do that, that was highly offensive. Another question, I guess, that became very, very apparent within the scope of things was, is the Christian faith against African culture? Is the Christian faith against African culture? Because there were certain things within Christian history, particularly in contemporary South Africa and other parts of Africa, I guess, in a broader context, where there were non-essentials of the Christian faith that were made to be essentials, but when you actually look back and begin to think about where they come from, you realize that they were actually just a part or an essential part of a European culture rather than being an essential or core of the Christian faith. And this wrapping, this sort of cultural wrapping around the Christian faith was all presented as a Christian faith, and hence you had a lot of African practices that actually had nothing to do, for instance, with ancestralism, that were then cut out and undermined through this process. And so people began asking, like myself, the question, is the Christian faith against African culture? For instance, if I become a Christian, do I need to let go of my African identity? And if I let go of my African identity, who do I become? Another question, why did God not make himself more clear to Africans? If really this is the type of God that people are speaking about, who's compassionate, who is kind, you know, who's for all people, why did he not make himself more clear to us? In other words, sort of an argument from the hiddenness of God in a contextual setting, in an African setting, that leads to other questions. So for me, just thinking about my grandmother, who was not a Christian, as far as I know, then I'd ask people, then what happened to her? What happened to those who've come before, the people that I had learned to honor, you know, people that I'd learned had shaped my cultural identity? What about them? What happened to them? And sort of in shorthand style, people would say, well, it's obvious. Those who actually die, you know, without knowing Jesus, becoming Christians, they go to hell. And so here am I trying to process this. Firstly, my grandma, it's not really my grandmother that I knew. It was actually demons, according to Christian theology. But secondly, everybody that you know, I really appreciate and have a deep sense of honor about them coming and have gone before me, shaping my cultural identity. These people have gone to hell. And in my mind, for no other reason except that they didn't meet or they weren't influenced by white people. You know, they didn't meet the white people with the book and so forth. It's really interesting because we're talking about this topic today, and some people actually, you know, still came up and they said, look, I'm deeply offended because actually somebody said this. And so although I'm sharing this from a personal perspective, what I want you to know is that these are the type of questions many people have and they carry deeply within their hearts. And so some of the things that we say, we need some sensitivity in the way we approach them, in the way we engage in dialogue, making sure that the terms we use are not necessarily ones that betray our cultural wrapping and biases, that we actually get to understand where people are coming from, then we can have a meaningful discussion about these issues. And I think there's also sometimes a mistake to think that, you know, when you think about maybe the worldview that I'm describing in terms of as ancestralism, that maybe it's for those people who are sort of uneducated, you know, they lack sort of essential basic critical thinking skills, you know, probably still deep down in the rural areas and so forth. But I've been amazed at how many people are intrigued when I begin to say, actually, no, there are many people today who are not within that sort of, who's not in that box today, who still hold deeply to many of these values. In fact, you'd be surprised at how much our country today actually goes through the lens of this particular worldview. How many things actually determine a lot of the decisions that are made in this country. It determines a lot of the trends, a lot of the cultural trends that you can map out as you go through the different parts and aspects of South Africa and South African public life, whether that's political life, whether that's business and so forth. And somebody like me coming from that background, excuse me, I look and I listen to some of the things people say, mostly sometimes through direct translation. You know, you have somebody who says it or thinks maybe this thing in one particular language, say Sesotho, and then they translate it in English. But when you hear in English, you sort of don't know what it means. But when I translate it back in Sesotho, then I know, this person is actually betraying the assumption that he holds that's actually coming from his background in ancestralism. I'll give you an example, perhaps, of what I mean. So I listened to many conversations about bribery, you know, about particularly with the whole tender process. And then I was thinking about that, and a friend of mine tells me, he says, well, you know, I'm submitting this application, and somebody says to me, you know, you have to put something on the table because I have to eat. That's the language some people use. Yeah, you got to put something on the table. I'm not sure if you know what I'm referring to in terms of, you know, the bribery that goes on. I'm a government official, you know, responsible for, you know, signing off tenders, whatever. People apply. I say, maybe the tender's worth 5 million. I say, well, thank you for your application. You know, knock it up to 6 million. And perhaps, I don't know if those are the accurate figures, knock it up to six million and so forth. And what I will do is then, you know, when I pay you, you'll then give me the 1 million in my pocket. Basic, you know, economics of bribery. But if you refuse, the whole idea is, you're coming to the table empty-handed. I need to eat as well. When I heard this, I was intrigued because the language is very similar, for instance, to the one we used to use growing up whenever we visited the Sangoma, for instance. Sangoma, sorry, the term I use there is somebody who's basically a mediator. You can see them as a mediator between, you know, the living and the dead. Okay, this is a person who's trained to be able to get possessed by ancestors and hence has the way to communicate, you know, to communicate between us and our ancestors. This very, very important individual within the worldview. We would go and we would be told we never pay them anything. Okay, there's no payment. However, we would still bring, firstly, relational gifts. And then more on top of that, we would say, well, you know what, since they don't work necessarily for a living, they need to eat. And so we would bring always, you know, sort of chickens and so forth to them, and we would give that to them, but that would never be seen as payment of any sort whatsoever. And we would say they need to eat. And so when I hear somebody say, I need to eat, I'm just thinking, man, this is, you know, the same thing plus greed times, you know, 100. But it is actually betraying someone's actual assumptions. And actually, some people struggle to see how is it, you know, that it is actually bribery. So when you call it bribery, I call it a relational gift. And there are many, many examples like this that I can really think of. But anyway, for the sake of time, just to say, this is not just something that happens in a hut somewhere in a rural village. This is something that happens all the time, especially in our public life. But these are the questions I began to, you know, to process growing up, particularly taking an interest in, you know, the Christian faith. And I began to look around to see how do people actually process this tension, because, you know, the average person coming from this particular background has a tension when they engage on one end ancestralism and on the other hand the Christian faith. And so I was interested to see how people are processing this particular tension. How do they reconcile it? And the first way I found that people actually, probably if you go to the next slide, thank you, to consider the cancer of the Christian faith, or the Christian faith as an invading cancer, that we need to actually perform some form of surgery to remove so that we can have a truly authentic African identity. Sort of what captures it is Kwasi Wiredu on his paper on decolonizing African religions. We need the disentanglement of the African framework of thought from colonial impositions. Of course, this is, goes wider than just the Christian faith, but the Christian faith is seen as obviously a vehicle for the, some of these colonial impositions that have now particularly invaded the African narrative, and we need to somehow disentangle that. Then there were other people who really, if you go to the next one, instead of seeing it as a cancer, which was more of a diplomatic, I think, approach, you know, I call it the tale of non-overlapping centers of knowledge. And the basic idea is, okay, historically speaking, what we have is we have, you know, a Western Europe that has set itself up as a center of knowledge, the center of knowledge, whether that's academically speaking, you know, or whatever. But what we need to do is actually decenter, you know, like Ngugi wa Thiong'o would say, we need to decenter, you know, Western Europe as a center so that we can make way for many other equally valid and possibly parallel centers of knowledge. So you've got the, you know, ancestralism, you know, as a worldview, as a center of knowledge. And if you're happy with that and it's working for you, then that's great. And that's equally as valid as those who are practicing or who believe in the Christian faith, who have adopted that as a center of knowledge. And in this sense, we have many centers. So just to see them actually as just being equally valid among many others. But I think, historically speaking, the third way is probably the one that most people subscribe to. The blended way, the third way. Actually, what we can do is bring the two together. You know, maybe what we'll do is take some of the most essential stuff, you know, from, you know, the Christian faith and take some of the most essential stuff from ancestralism and we'll blend them together. In fact, I think it's part of why the language has changed. So nobody says ancestralism is my religion. They would say it's my culture. So I can be a Christian by religion, but I can by cultural practice, I can be an African. In fact, that's also why, I guess, when people started to criticize, well, you can't be a Christian if you pray to your ancestors, people started nuancing that really well to say, no, we don't pray to our ancestors. We pray to God through our ancestors. And that was is a very important distinction. And in fact, when I was recently, I was discussing this, you know, on Power FM, and I had a lot of people begin to call in and they'll say, no, but we don't worship and we don't, you know, pray to our ancestors. We praise our ancestors. And people started throwing different alternative phrases to actually try and help me, you know, understand, which I found it hilarious because many of them were not actually, haven't practiced ancestralism to try and help me understand what ancestralism was really about. You know, perhaps, you know, because you've been corrupted, you've been brainwashed by, you know, white people, you don't understand the African way. So let me help you. It's not ancestral worship. It's not praying to. It's actually praising and honoring. You know, people would nuance it that way. And I found it intriguing because, like I say, is my analysis of ancestralism is not really a matter of wordplay, semantics, and so forth. It's got to do a lot with what actually my experience and the experience of many people actually is, was, and is. And actually what the actual practice entails. Not so much, you know, what the words mean. And so anyway, I began to see how somehow also I realized that ancestralism made sense mostly and it took up positions mostly where Christian theology seemed to be in, especially in its presentation, seemed to have a lot of gaps. So when I look back historically, for instance, you know, finding different tales, different stories, you know, of some, maybe in some places where missionaries came, you know, encountered people practicing ancestralism, because of the biggest influence within that cultural wrapping coming from Europe at the time, rationalism, people would say, well, this is just superstitious nonsense. You're not really having an experience of that which is supernatural. That actually doesn't exist. You think you are, and you're susceptible to believing that because, you know, obviously your background has given you these, you know, categories of thought, and therefore you're reinterpreting every experience based on that. You're actually not really having a supernatural experience. It's just superstitious nonsense. You need to stop that, and you need to become a Christian, and you need to believe this. This is now your religion. And people said, all right, that makes sense. You've got the guns. But the problem was, on Monday, so on Sunday, dress up, of course, lose the African clothes, because those are, you know, non-Christian. Go to church on Sunday. But what would happen on Monday was that when my child was sick, then I'd take them to church. And I'd say, look, I think someone's cursing my child. And then the minister would say, well, that's just superstition. We know about the germ theory now. What you need to do is take your child to the hospital. They'll determine what's wrong with the child, and we'll actually begin to treat the child. None of that cursed stuff. And then this person would get confused. This family would be confused. You see, if this person's experience was anything like mine, where growing up, when there was some form of calamity in the family or somebody was sick, we used to go to the hut, to the sangoma, or would have the ceremony at home, host that. And before we arrived, we wouldn't announce that we were going to see her. We would just leave as a family, leave very early in the morning. When we arrived, this lady, you could, I think for this purpose, consider her our family doctor, she was waiting for us already. Because the ancestors had told her we were coming. We never surprised her. And when we arrived, she would tell us why we were there. She would tell us what the problem was, in a sense, which was a way to actually give us the confidence that she could help us. And then we would perform a ceremony, and then we would, whatever the solution was. So if that's the case, already if I take my child to the church and I'm told, what's wrong with your child, what are the symptoms, I'm already suspicious, thinking, how does this work? Why do I need to tell, you know, him, her, what the problem is? And furthermore, they're going to do tests to try and find out. I know what works. As a parent, maybe you're desperate, you're seeing your child, you know, and you still believe, well, I've never heard sermons about curses and so forth. I've never heard that part of theology being taught. So maybe what I need to do actually is process this, take this child to where the child can get help, and then begin to reconcile the two. Oh, I see. Christian faith is my religion. But the thing that answers some of my existential questions and some of my practical questions is actually ancestralism. And the two actually begin to blend. Anyway, my thoughts about this, as I begin to move on, the first thing, if you go to the next slide, is that I realized that what I call the third way produces sort of these theological and cultural hypocrites. Theologically speaking, I struggle to see how one can actually reconcile the two. In fact, this was a very harsh thing, because I really desired for the two to actually blend in some way, some meaningful way for me, so that I could be fully Christian and fully, and you know, African in how I interpreted it. However, I came across a lot of scriptures, and I just put some of this from the biblical text to show, actually, that I came across these sort of Bible verses which spoke, and you know, very, very unkindly, to put it mildly, against certain core practices in ancestralism. Things that you couldn't have ancestralism without were forbidden in many parts of the Bible. So for instance, you know, in the first, in Deuteronomy 18:11, you have a place where actually interpreting omens is forbidden. Let no one amongst you be found who is actually a medium or spiritist. You know, somebody who communicates with the dead, or anybody who consults with the dead. You couldn't have ancestralism if you couldn't have someone who could actually communicate, or you as a family couldn't communicate with those who were dead. Or in Isaiah, the same issue in Isaiah, you know, where God takes issue with people saying, with his people particularly, consulting, you know, the dead on behalf of the living. And the whole thing there is, should not God's people inquire of God, not the dead? And I think the one that cut right through the heart of it is that last one in 1 Timothy 2:5, where the whole idea there is that there is only one God and one mediator between man and God, and that's Jesus Christ. And many other scriptures where you see there's an emphasis of Jesus Christ's unique and exclusive role in being a mediator between God and man, and playing the only intercessory role, the only, you know, go in between. And so when we said, no, this is how I relate to God through my ancestors, that would be something that would be really very hard to reconcile, because it's a very strong part of the Christian faith. But equally so, not just from a Christian perspective, but also from ancestralism, there were certain practices which I felt were very core, they were very important, that were not necessarily easy to reconcile with the Christian faith, I guess. Because I sort of thought, you know, I'll take the concept of in ethics for now. I always had an issue, I guess, with the fact that whenever we would go, let's say somebody there was some problem that's happening in the family, you know, whenever we're sleeping, we keep on hearing, you know, noises on the roof, and in the middle of the night, people aren't sleeping, there are voices in the house, and so forth. I'm just trying as best as I can to bring you into my experience growing up. So I'm not making these examples just, you know, for the sake of it. I'm saying these are the things which I grew up experiencing. And we might have a very good discussion about it afterwards, if that's what's happening in your house. I doubt it very much, though. But if something like that was happening, or somebody was sick, we would go and, you know, to consult, and we would then say, we want to find out with, you know, Sangoma, what's going on. And then she would almost 100% of the time respond that it was actually someone within either the family or the neighboring, the community rather, in our community, the immediate community, who had actually put a curse on us as a family. And almost in all the cases that I can remember, the solution was to lift the curse and then send it back to the person who actually cursed us, which was a very difficult thing to reconcile when you thought about some of the things that, you know, were essential parts of Christian character, you know, talking about praying and loving your enemies. That was very difficult to reconcile and think about it in those terms, especially, I guess, in the New Testament. Or the aspect of somebody, maybe like one of my kids, this has happened so many times in my family, where there is one of my cousins or, you know, brothers who would experience, you know, a series of, you know, bad events. A series of bad events would happen in their life. So maybe say they would get into a car accident, then, you know, lose a job. You know, they can't hold on to their job, you know, in some way or another. They always get fired. Whenever they get a new job, they, you know, something will happen at work and they'll get fired, and they'll try and apply for another job, and it will be just a cycle of some of these things where they get fired and it's a car accident or something like that. And then somebody would look and say, well, look, there's actually a pattern here of calamity of some sort. How do we make sense of it? And then we would go, you know, through a ceremony and try to discern what do the ancestors make of this. And then, you know, the idea is that the response would be, well, you see, this guy was born out of wedlock. And because he was born out of wedlock, then he took his mother's surname as a practical thing to do, or whatever. But what ended up happening is that now the ancestors are actually angry with that, and they are now, you know, causing this in his life, so to get his attention. And the solution is he now needs to actually change his surname to take on his father's surname. Okay. Many people, this has happened in their lives. In fact, there was a famous soccer star who in this country that happened to as well, you know, not too long ago. But my question was, when I knew some of my cousins, I'd always question, I'd ask, where's the element of personal responsibility here? Because I would see that actually they got fired because they got to work drunk. And sometimes they just wouldn't show up and just go hang out with friends and so forth. Where I would trace, you know, almost like this, you know, I'd have this idea that actually if you just actually acted responsibly and showed up to work on time and actually don't drink the night before work and don't just skip work and leave whenever you want to, actually have a good work ethic when you're at work, then perhaps you won't get fired. Because all of these things, I can trace all the times you were dismissed from something that, you know, was directly, you know, traced to you, or rather the whole idea of you are responsible for. I don't see any supernatural forces coming in and causing you to do this thing. You find a lot of these issues that are very hard to reconcile. However, if he just goes to consult with the ancestors, it's a ceremony away from fixing it because there's a curse or the ancestors are angry with him or something like that. Also, I guess, you know, it also produces within a society, I guess there's a lot of people have this, what I call cultural shapeshifters. People that are very hard to get to hold accountable, because people say, you see, I'm a Christian, but I'm also an African. And so what happens is if they lead a particular life that you begin to, particularly in public, that you begin to criticize based on Christian principles, they will say, well, you don't know my culture. You don't understand my culture. And I accuse you of ethnocentrism. But if we, some of us from within that cultural practice, begin to criticize them for something that they do based on how we expect them to behave according to assumptions that we think we both share, being traditional people, they say, no, we don't practice that part of culture. And so what happens is they criticize from this side, they move to the other side. And so they actually begin to treat either the African, you know, what you call cultural practices, or the Christian faith as it's like a sort of some sort of buffet. You know, just take what works and what you like, especially one that will further excuse the type of life that you live. And this is what the problem I have with many of our politicians today who say they are very traditional or very cultural. And we have many discussions on how we could possibly hold many people accountable, but it's very hard because they're both Christian, you know, so therefore there's certain things in culture they don't practice. But they are also cultural, so when you criticize them based on the Christian worldview, then you're being ethnocentric. So there's some way what people use to sort of try and reconcile this to create the third way. But the third way doesn't really work, I think, in my opinion, to produce anything that's authentically either Christian or in any sense representing ancestralism in its most significant form, any meaningful form. So anyway, in conclusion, there is another way which I began to see as a way in order to reconcile it for me personally. This has been something that I've started to find very satisfactory and has been able to help me begin to reconcile this tension in my own life. And in a sense, this is sort of the research I'm currently involved in doing. But I'm just going to give sort of broad strokes, which is this, the fourth way. I propose the fourth way. So neither seeing it as a cancer, neither seeing it as two non-overlapping sort of what you call centers of knowledge, neither creating this elusive and mythical third way. But actually then I began to say the Christian faith or Christianity is the African way. And the main thing about that, or my main thesis, was Christianity in Africa is old enough to be considered an African indigenous religion. Christianity in Africa is old enough to be considered an African indigenous religion. Now, this was very important, of course, for me to widen my view about history and about, you know, the Christian faith or the Christian story. Because up to this point, you know, the history of South Africa began in 1488 in my mind. So I needed to reverse the clock a little bit beyond that. And also I needed to grow my idea of what South Africa is, because for many South Africans, South Africa represents Africa. You know, or they move to the other extreme where South Africa is not in Africa. You know, so I have this experience where I speak to some of my friends and I tell them that I was in some, you know, country like Nigeria, and they say, "Wow, you went to Africa?" You know, so I needed to grow sort of my brain to think about that and actually begin to say, let me consider some of, you know, some of the migrations that took place. You know, where do sub-Saharan Africans actually come from? What are their histories? Obviously, from the history written by Africans. Because that's a very important distinction when you get into history. You know, we have the history of the conquerors, you know, which everybody seems to, you know, dispute. So I thought, is there a place where I can maybe begin to draw conclusions from our own history told by our own people? And that's when I came up with this. That Christianity, this is the conclusion. Christianity in Africa is old enough to be an indigenous African religion. I began to trace it, firstly, to try and think about it from a biblical perspective, and then on the other side, to try and think about it from our own history, to see if we can arrive at the same conclusion. And maybe for the purpose of tonight, I'm only going to have time probably to talk about the biblical one. To say, well, in the Bible, let's see this. If actually we this is an African story, then I expect to somehow be able to trace some, what you call, lineage of some sort in a very significant way from the Bible. Because again, the Christian story doesn't start, you know, in the New Testament. It goes all the way through to the Old Testament. So let me actually go to the Old Testament and actually begin to consider some of the things that has been spoken there. Could I find references of Africa, Africans, African nations, African cities, or anything like that? And I found that there's an overwhelming, you know, over 1,400 mentions in terms of that category, with Egypt and, you know, Ethiopia, Kush taking a very significant part of that, the lion's share of the mention. You know, Kush is considered from anyway the biblical perspective to be a descendant of sub-Saharan Africans. I'm not sure if you watched the movie Noah recently. Kush was, you know, the son of Ham's son of Noah. Okay, if you haven't watched the movie, I don't know, many people love it, hate it. I would recommend that you watch it for the one thing that I really loved. You know, spoiler alert, very mild spoiler alert. Don't worry, it won't ruin your experience, especially if you know the story. I really enjoyed this one particular fact about this movie. And that in the whole movie, there are no black people. There are no black people in that movie. Not a single black person. Now, let me tell you why I particularly like that. It's because, you know, you're watching a movie about Noah, you know a lot of people are going to die. Thank you. Not for those racist reasons that you're thinking right now. Purely because I had a complex when I watched movies that, you know, and many, it's interesting, because there are many people who think this, that actually, you know, in many movies, black people are the first to die. Usually black people are the first to die. And so if you're watching a movie where there are no black people, you sort of think, ooh, this is interesting. Now it's very, very mysterious, very intriguing. Which white person is going to die first? I don't know. You know, you've got to figure that out as you watch the movie. I encourage you to have this conversation with people. Ask them, so do you think that black people are the first to die in movies? Many people have this complex, you see. Anyway, go watch the movie. But Kush, the king of Kush at one stage plays a very significant role in the Bible, where actually the king of Kush, representing, I guess, an African mention, comes into the military aid of Israel. And so you begin to sketch out this whole idea of a salvific role that the Africans actually played, or African nations played also in the history of Israel, particularly because I didn't want just some of those mentions to be sort of arbitrary, almost like having extras in the movie. You know, so God has his favorite people and he thinks, okay, well, they need to fight and conquer. They need a great story, so they need people to kill. And let's put the Africans there, you know, along the way or something like that. Would be terrible just to have a mention as an extra. But you actually begin to see a very significant role that they play. Also in the New Testament, maybe worth a mention. There are many mentions, but worth a mention is that during one of the most significant moments of the Christian church, what many consider the birth of the Christian church, or one of the events really, the inauguration of the Christian church in some way or another, where the Holy Spirit actually comes down onto, you know, the disciples, that Africans are there. And the record there tells us that actually, you know, they actually heard God being praised in their languages. In other words, God took the time, you know, to somehow translate, so that they didn't have to translate themselves to be part of the experience of what was going on, but the experience was being broadcasted to where they are within their context. I guess communicating the idea that they are very much a part of that story. And again, you know, through the early church history, some of the most influential Christian thinkers, again, were involved as Africans. And some of the churches today actually don't trace, I realized this, and this was a shock to me, they don't trace their actual, what you call, lineage to missionaries, Western missionaries. There are many African churches that don't, especially in the northern parts of Africa. And that actually was very intriguing for me to see actually that actually when we talk about, you know, missionaries bringing Christianity to Africa, I began to realize this was a mere reintroduction as opposed to an introduction. It was a reintroduction. Because in many ways, like I said, the Christian story was actually an African story. And so, in other words, if, you know, considering some of those implications, what it means. And look, I could make the same or sort of argument, not from a biblical side of view, but from an African history's point of view. But I'm not going to do that just tonight. But I began to think, what are sort of the implications of this? And my conclusion was this, that actually, you know, maybe the Christian faith was not an invading cancer, but it was actually an African story just of a displaced identity. That somewhere along the line, throughout the history, we could actually tell when the Christian faith, almost like phasing in and phasing out of the Christian, of the African narrative. It was a matter of a displaced identity, that truly one could find an African identity within the Christian narrative. And actually, some of the critiques, you see, if you begin to look at how Christianity is being practiced, then you realize that some of the criticism that was coming from, you know, African philosophy, for instance, was not a critique on actual Christian theology, but on its practice and its history on the African continent, where the Christian faith was, it was not the case, rather, that the Christian faith was lived out so much that its evils and its gaps and so forth were actually eventually exposed within the African continent and actually contributed to some of the problems that we have, but that actually it wasn't lived out enough, where there were those theological and other gaps. Actually, other silent partners, let me say this, of the Christian faith had actually crept in to be what we now think is a Christian faith being practiced, but actually, it's actually many others, it's actually a sort of, you know, a combination of sorts, you know, a soup of sorts between the Christian faith and other actual religious beliefs, which sort of dominate in practice, even although the word Christian dominates in mention and in the title, but in practice it's actually something else other than the Christian faith. And so the critique is actually not towards Christian theology, but its practice on the African continent. And then finally, then it was just a matter of thinking through the question about the Messiah. Not to get too much into that, but obviously when I began to think about, you know, the Christian faith as a truly African narrative, I began then to think, well, Africa does need a savior. And for me, just taking the shortcut to say, then have to think about what type of savior that Africa actually needs, because obviously those assumptions that we make when we ask the question. And doing some thinking along that line, I eventually come to the point where I think, well, I think the biggest problem that I find is what I call the human condition. What is wrong with the human heart? Because I can tell, as far as I know, that many of these problems are actually not just on a surface. They look on a surface level like it's poverty. It's just poverty. Of course, that's real. Or illiteracy, or disease, and so forth. But ultimately, it's the human heart from which, you know, assumptions are coming from. And this actually perpetuates the problem that when I want to see people being fed, I want to see better distribution of resources, I'd like to see advance and, you know, in technology where disease is not a problem anymore, HIV and AIDS and so forth. But I realize that actually even when we in the face of that, there seems to be a deeper issue and a deeper problem for me at least. And therefore, I begin to track back and say, well, what sort of narrative amongst these competing narratives within the African context actually gives me that kind of solution? And I guess it was, for me, the Christian faith, particularly the central figure being Jesus Christ, who then, you know, according to Christian theology, there's talk about changing a person's heart, you know, giving a human being a regenerate heart, a new heart from which new assumptions actually can begin to flow from, whereas all the other narratives that so far I've been able to investigate, and other people, other sort of African theologians and African philosophers, one notable one, I guess, is John S. Mbiti, if you're keen on reading some more about this. And he would say, you know, that actually it's actually the Christian story that promises this kind of a Messiah, and which is what I believed is the kind of Messiah that Africa needs. And so therefore, if for me, I began to answer this question, yes, Jesus is, you know, the Messiah for Africa. In those kind of steps. But not only is he a Messiah for Africa, but I guess in what I'm saying is a Messiah for Africans and African people. But of course, it's another story to talk about those other white people, which is another time, another talk. But for now, I'll stop there and maybe take a few questions. Do you still have good time to take questions, Johan? Or not?
Yeah, but I just want to say what Nobel is, there's chips coming in and there's coffee coming in. Or maybe the coffee is not coming in. Maybe you have to go out for the coffee. But do come back in after you've taken the coffee. But yeah, so there's a brief full try on Wonders Kijken, what they call, in East India and East India. And on the other floor, what you need for Winston, come on now. Gewoonlik is die eerste vraag of hy single is, anders is nee. Hy is getroud met 'n maand ouer babatjie. So enige tweede vraag.
Someone asked if he's single.
What's that?
Is he single?
Yeah.
You just say, okay. All right, so I can go on to the next
second question. Yeah, thank you.
is the ZCC Church, is that part of this, what you call now the just for person standing outside.
Yeah.
Is there ancestral worship there, or is that a full-blown Christian, or what's happening there?
Ooh, that's a very, very, very hard question. No, as far as I know, the ZCC Church actually speaks against ancestralism. I know there's a perception that they perpetuate it through their practices. But if you actually speak to some of the guys who are in leadership, and they actually speak against it, although you find in practice there are people who still get involved ancestral practices, let me call them that way. But I think the official stance is to actually speak against it. They may include other practices which they don't consider to be part of ancestralism, which might be problematic, I think, with maybe the, you know, Christian theology. But the short answer is, as far as I know, the official position is to speak against ancestralism. Yes, sir.
I've got two questions. The
sure.
First one, how is ancestralism connected with the government officials, especially concerning the president and the Anga scandal? Second, why is cultural identity...
Well, we'll take
this. Okay.
I need some more water. Have we stopped recording? That's a great question. How is ancestralism connected to some of our government officials? Firstly, well, I think if you've seen over the course of our South African history recently, from I guess if you talk about from 94, there's been several ceremonies that the government has actually hosted on behalf of our country. One of them included, actually, I think it was here at the Union Buildings, where we had a ceremony to invite all sort of the spirits of our you know, dead and fallen heroes who died abroad, you know, while training, for instance, you know, to overthrow Johann's ancestors, and they died, and to bring them back, and we finally say, we have taken over, this is home, come home, and now this make this your home, you know. So we've had practices that the government has actually officiated and hosted on behalf of the country. I guess that would be, you know, the direct answer.
With taxpayers' money as well.
Say again, please.
With
let me be diplomatic and say, I don't know. Maybe there was somebody who funded that practice, but with money, yes, because you need a lot of cows. So with someone's money. I don't want to comment instead of whose money was being used there. Another thing was many of our politicians actually would say, and you'd hear some of these things when someone is criticizing somebody, they would say stuff like, how dare you criticize an elder? You know, this betrays, I guess, an assumption that comes from ancestralism, because it's something, for me, even today, I still choke, and it's very difficult to criticize somebody who's an elder. And I've tried to think through, why is that the case? Is this just a normal cultural value of honor and respect and so forth? But it seems to not balance, I guess, with the whole idea of accountability. So that in my mind, at least, I could only trace it to say, well, I guess the older you are, the closer you are to becoming an ancestor. But this is just purely in my mind. I might say something as well about this, actually, to say I considered something, I guess, where it impacts economics in a sense and answers the question, that many black funerals are actually very expensive. In fact, many black families get into debt just to conduct a funeral. And this has a lot to do with the fact that the send-off is very important because of the role that you're going to play when you are dead. And so I've seen many of our sort of government officials actually putting together and saying certain things at funerals as well that betray this. But largely, I guess, it they carry some of these values which are actually more important than the Constitution in many cases. You know, many of us actually always appeal to the Constitution as the highest authority of the land, but actually it's, I think, the assumptions that our political leaders carry that seem to actually, you know, almost determine how that Constitution is actually handled in many cases. Yeah, so with regards to the president, you know what, let me relate to you a conversation that I had with a friend of mine about the whole Nkandla thing. And this is not a political, you know, comment, please. It's just, you know, to answer directly, to say, how is there a particular link? In my understanding, he's a Zulu person who's the head of a home, and who sort of would classify himself as somebody who practices African culture or ancestralism. There are certain practices, in my mind, I thought he needed, would have needed to do. So, particularly around the whole Nkandla situation. So, growing up, for instance, my father would if he was planning to build a house, or, you know, renovate or extend a home or something like that, we would get together as a family, and then he would know what's going on, and he would then speak to the ancestors and tell them, this is what I'm planning to do, and, excuse me, in that sense, get permission. But then, when I heard the president say, I did not know about, you know, these renovations, so why should I pay for them? I did not know. For me, it began to connect with that experience to say, why didn't you not know? Because as the head of the home, it was very important to have done this. So I began to speak to my Zulu friend, because this is one thing you need to also understand. There are very important you know, nuances of ancestralism amongst different ethnic groups even, and within those ethnic groups as well. So don't just make an assumption that, for instance, you spoke to someone who's Zulu, you know, and they told you this is how they do things, and this isn't necessarily how Xhosa people would do things, okay? Don't make that assumption. It's safer to ask the Xhosa person if this is the case rather than assuming. So I began to ask my friend, as I found out in this case, would the president have needed to have the ceremony if he was actually going to do anything to Nkandla, any extension? Then my friend said, no. In a Zulu culture, you don't actually need to do that if you're renovating. You only need to do that if you're building a new thing. Then you need to consult your ancestors. But if you're actually extending, you don't need to actually consult. You extend first, and then you come and have a look at what's happened, and then you invite, you know, the ancestors in on it. So you don't need to. And then we began to talk about how significant renovations are, you know, would they need to be in order for it to warrant a new work and that sort of thing. But what I found was, what was at stake was the question, was the president being traditional enough? Or was he using the whole idea of tradition to actually run away from the criticism on bad corporate governance that seemed to come from the West by saying, you know, as another minister, you know, said, which betrayed her assumptions, was you don't actually speak about an African man's kraal. That's his sacred space. If you're reading, you know, the newspaper, his sacred space. And he said, well, this is actually very disrespectful the way the people are talking because they don't understand my culture. And I'm not answering the question, but I'm just saying this is what sort of the conversations someone like me coming from ancestralism sees and hears and is a part of that many people who don't are not aware of.
My second question relates to cultural identity among black people. What happened after 1994, many, especially the younger generation like myself, are not always both familiar and unhappy with our racist history. So
not unhappy with the history?
Yeah, unhappy with.
Oh, you are unhappy.
We are unhappy.
Just making sure.
So yeah. The problem is many of us, I think most Afrikaner people, are in an identity crisis. We do not know who we are because in the past it was built on the fur trackers and the Boer War, and now we don't know who we are anymore. So it is very difficult for me to understand why most black people I know are very concerned about their African identity and why it's so important to them. Can you perhaps explain it to me?
Yeah, sure. Actually, this is very interesting because we at Port, we actually were talking about this this very issue, and around the braai, also yesterday, we're discussing this issue of cultural identity, and we're talking between, you know, black people and Afrikaner people and so forth. Many people would actually say, they feel this exact same way within the black community, where because of identity politics, there's always been a, you know, there's a history of actually labeling people not African enough, and it's always a bad thing. You're not African enough because, you know, many sort of black women would face this because, for instance, maybe they don't have what they call their natural hair. Maybe they put, you know, chemicals on their hair, or they've got braids instead of dreadlocks, and therefore they're not African enough. And somewhat the idea it communicates is they fake, you know, that they don't. And growing up, knowing that people were very incredibly proud of being not only black, but being a Sotho or a Zulu or this way you derive so cultural pride, all of a sudden to be thrown into this box where you're not anything is a bit of a nightmare. You don't speak, you know, one particular language, you know, like isiZulu, or you don't speak it enough to be black, a black person, suddenly throws them into a crisis. You speak English with this particular accent, you're not black enough. You're that kind of Christian that rejects ancestralism, you're not African enough. These are the same conversations that I found that were happening, I guess, within, you know, some Afrikaans communities that are actually happening within the black community. So, for instance, now even with the whole everybody going for the bond-free vote, it was actually quite interesting that the bond-free, the so-called bond-free, especially among the black people, were those people with that same identity crisis to say, I don't know where I belong, because actually, before the elections, The rhetoric was, you know, people who don't know their African roots, who are not connected, they're not African enough, and all of a sudden, just closer to the elections, everyone's holding rallies where they're trying to reach them for their vote. And so I guess it's important because we grow up being told, if you stop being African, you're nothing. And these are the practices and these are the things. Of course, they're always evolving, but it's very important to say, then what do I become? You know, who do I become? Especially considering our history, it was a history of, you know, being African is cool, you know, and then that was displaced slightly, you know, by colonialism. And so if now post 94 we can go back and be proud again of that identity, then that's again very cool. But then it seems like many people aren't welcome. And I found that especially among the youth, there's an increasing number of black people who fall within that category. And to be honest, I think it's probably rooted in having the conversation. Like, for instance, when I was on radio, just before me, the conversation was, you know, what makes an African, who's actually an African and who's not. That was the discussion. And within there, it basically, who's black and who's not. You know, there's another nuance within there because nobody has a problem defining Europeans from that perspective, but it's another whole deal to try and define who's black and who's African. Yes, sir.
In the beginning of your talk, you mentioned that when one speaks of an African way, the concepts of ancestral practices and ancestralism is included. And in the conclusion was that the Christian faith is actually also an African story.
Yes.
Are those concepts still included, or how does it differ from the initial concept you described?
Sure. Thank you for that, actually. For giving me an opportunity to just bring clarity to that. I guess I... Now when I think about the African way, I take sort of into consideration the whole body of knowledge, language, you know, popular art and so forth, that kind of stuff within the African context. Although, in the beginning I spoke about it from an insider perspective because a core part of that would be the belief in ancestors and relationships with the ancestors. In fact, many people today wouldn't consider African language, they wouldn't be referring to an African language when they say culture, they'd just be purely referring to, you know, the ancestors. I find that today, of course, today there are certain essential cultural practices that actually can be sort of divorced from ancestors or ancestralism, and are uniquely African, and I actually love them. I actually love, say, for instance, the concept of Lobola. Now, I think Lobola is a great idea. In the way that it was supposed to be practiced. You know, a lot's happened. You know, greed's come in, and the way Lobola actually, I hear people talking about it, is more they critique the abuse of it as opposed to actually what it was supposed to be. That's what I would consider the African way. But going back, if you consider how Lobola is being practiced, it's very, the whole idea is of course, that if you've got two people who are about to get married, within the African context, it's not just individuals who are getting married, it's their families that are getting married. So somehow we need a process that facilitates the families coming together because at least the individuals will be married and go live together, but things will be a bit difficult for the families, so we need to facilitate this before the individuals get married. So Lobola is actually designed, actually in the way it was supposed to be practiced, actually to facilitate families coming together. You know, so as you know, so people would let me just say from one particular, you know, context, you know, I would go to my father and I say, you know, there's a girl, you know, that I'd like to marry. We'd send a letter or a message there. They would give us a date, you know, to bring the family, and then I'd pick, you know, within my family, those would go and represent me, and then they would go. I'm not allowed to go, right? Because the idea is families need to learn how to relate without me. So they go there to speak on my behalf. They get there, and you know, during that time, her family has also gathered, you know, some critical or some important people within their family to interact with, my uncles and my aunts and so forth during that time. But then, you know, the start of the process might look like this. You know, they stand outside, somebody comes outside and asks them, who are you? Of course they know who they are, but it's a series of games, you see. It's fun, cultural, you know, fun, where people say, who are you? Then they say this is who they are. They say, would like to speak to the father of the family. The father comes out and says, I won't speak to you. And then they say, all right, we're going to give you a cow. Can you speak to us? You know, we'll give you ivulimlomo, which means it's the open the mouth. You know, the conversation starter, you know, very expensive conversation starter. And it's a cow. And then somebody would say, okay, now I'm willing to talk because you owe me a cow. You know, what are you here to discuss? And then they say, no, we're here to discuss, one of your daughters. And then he would be shocked. You know, literally in the old days, he'd climb up a tree. You know, he wouldn't get down. And so now we have to give him something called Tobin Trizio, which is sort of, console the heart. Direct translation. We have to give him a console the heart, which is another cow. Now we owe two cows. And the process continues. And you understand that this process is there's a lot of fun. There's a lot of laughter because you know what to expect. And it's a series of games and so forth. And the whole idea of cows was that at the end of the lobola ceremony, you see, what we needed to do was we need to have a lobola celebration, which was actually the wedding. And for the wedding, well, it was practical within the African context because you know you're going to have a lot of people, you need to feed them. Remember, within this context, if you know about it, you're invited. All right? So everybody comes. No, I'm serious. It's actually some people, you hear them talking like this, they say, I don't know why that family didn't come. They knew this was happening. We didn't need to send them an invitation. They knew. The fact that they knew, they should have been here. So people come. So there was also another practical way to actually provide for the wedding. You see, that's what the whole thing was about. But of course, in modern days, you know, the African guy, now the black guy now has to actually do, you know, the wedding proposal, you know. He has to do the engagement ring. He has to do the engagement party. He has to do the lobola, you know, the lobola celebrations. And then there's also another ceremony there where my family goes over to her family. And all the relatives come out and we give them gifts and we call them out. The aunts from this side, we call out the whole family tree basically and give them gifts. And they come to our family, they give us gifts. By the time we leave with my wife, they know my family, who's the aunt, who's the uncle, such that our celebrations are their celebrations. Whenever there's a funeral in my family, it's like their funeral and that sort of thing. That's how it was supposed to be. But these days, it's actually become a transaction. So you actually pay lobola and the father takes it. And you still need to budget for the wedding, which was not supposed to happen that way. That was actually, the lobola was actually supposed to be to make provision for that. This is, so I'm giving this example, sorry to go so elaborate, but this whole idea was that in the way it was practiced, it was an African way. But today, in many ways, it can still be done, and I still insist on it being done whenever I have a hand in it. But what I do remove is the other side that people would say is our culture, which involves ancestralism. So I did the whole process that I've just described without the idea of ancestralism because I found that disagreeable, you know, with the way I practice my faith. I hope that made clarity. The terms are very shifty. You know, when we talk about the African way, the African culture, ancestralism, and so forth, they are very, very shifty. It depends on who you're talking to. Are you talking as an insider voice? Or are you talking generally, objectively speaking, to, you know, multicultural crowd? Next question. Yes, sir.
Hi, Winston.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. Just for chance, I think the book Isaiah refers to some of those lobola concepts where provision is made either for the family or for the wife in some sense. So it's just...
Thank you. Please, you need to tell me of those references. That'll be great.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Then... My next question is, at the beginning you said when someone told you that worshipping ancestors is actually worshipping demons, you said it was very rude, but can you maybe just give an explanation or for those experiences? Because you did go to the Sangoma, he did know about the sickness, and it's very difficult for me then to explain this, because how do I then minister to people from that environment without... being offensive, but I mean the gospel does have certain things that are rude to some people. It is a difficult thing. So
sure,
on that question.
It's a great question. It's also the least favorite to answer. this question. Well, I think within the it all boils down to the fact of what your basis is for interpreting that experience. The reason why it was offensive to me was somebody was coming and communicate was talking to me from purely from a biblical Christianity framework of interpretation. And in their mind, biblically speaking, if it's a truly an authentically supernatural experience, we could say a demonstration of power, then there were only two sources, you know, for that, which was either God or Satan. And so if it wasn't God's activity, supernatural activity, by way of, I guess, deduction, then it was Satan's, you know, process of elimination. And if it was Satan's, then it was satanic agency, maybe demonic, what we call demonic activity, that actually was then responsible for that demonstration of power and so forth. And it lines up with, I guess, the biblical text, you know. So for instance, you go back and you realize that actually within these texts that actually there were people who were engaged in those practices, and they seem to actually have authentic supernatural also experiences, and it doesn't deny that experience, it just categorizes it into this is not of God. And so you have, so for instance, if you have, you know, Pharaoh and, you know, performing miracles, there's in a biblical, you know, setting, there's also Pharaoh's magicians actually performing, you know, some form of supernatural acts or miracles to try and counter that experience. And so it's within the biblical framework where somebody's coming from and he's saying, actually, this is from a biblical point of view, this is actually demonic activity or satanic agency that's responsible to explain that experience. I think where a lot of people miss it, and this is what I would agree with, the only problem is that sometimes we expect people to have our assumptions too quickly before arriving at that place. You see, for me, I couldn't even process some of this biblical story, you know, that was so far removed from me. The thing that was closest to me was, man, I went into a hut, and I've been going there for a number of years, and I've been enjoying this wonderful experience with what I believe is my grandmother. And so what I would advise for people, you know, like yourself coming from where you're coming from, is that first let's have a discussion where you understand what are my basic assumptions, so that if I understand where you're coming from, then I can understand what you mean. So not to arrive at a conclusion that merely says your ancestors are demons, but to actually see, let's actually have a process and a discussion where you see what are my assumptions that are different from your assumptions, and then we can talk about those. You can challenge me, but don't arrive too quickly at the conclusion, you know, that you have arrived at because you've accepted the Christian worldview, and I'm still hanging on to a very, you know, important foundational parts of my what you call ancestral worldview. Make sense? Well, the conclusion is that I think biblical Christianity would say it is satanic activity.
I appreciate the thing that you said.
Sure.
Engage with someone.
Yes.
To understand their assumptions.
Thank you so much for your time. I believe this is Time Up. If I see you.
Well, yeah, that's what I represent.
Yeah.
Time Up.
Yeah.
So before you run away. Guys, get used to Winston. You're going to see a lot of him in the future. He, whether he likes it or not, is a friend of the Aluach, and a friend of this ministry. And I've been trying to convince him to move to Gauteng. At the moment, he's living in Durban, which is not really an intellectual hub of any sort. So as he's moving out, please don't ask him any questions. Just command him to come into Gauteng. His wife, Lusanda, really wants to move here. Although she's probably never been here. She really wants to move here. And your baby as well, who's a month old. I spoke to her last night. And, she's also very keen on moving here. But Winston, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And he was a week away from his month-old baby. The biggest sacrifice he's ever made in his life.
True.
And you got through it, and by tomorrow morning he'll be back.
Hold on, Wednesday, I had to go back.
Changing wipers and those kind of things.
Yeah, yeah.
Got wipers, diapers as well. Yeah. Although your car needs to do some changing as well. Go sit down and thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, one last thing. We really don't go on this late. It's Winston's fault. The weird American you heard just a while ago, Zach, you can come forward to him. He is quickly going to give you an hour sermon just basically about his life and where he comes from. No, actually, he's going to do it next week. So we're trying to get a good international vibe. So this is a 2-minute sharp introduction. You can time him if you want to. What Zach is going to speak on next week, Sunday. He's much better than Winston, by the way.
Thank you. So I came over with Winston, not because I'm an apologist. We met in Oxford, actually, and can't remember if our wives led worship at a church first or if we spoke together in the same school first, but we met. 2 minutes. Okay, sure. I'll have a couple of thoughts for you guys, but I guess I won't share them. It's tough not to. I have a book I want you to read. Don't let me forget. So one thing, next week I want to talk to you about really what it means to be incarnational and be a missional community. Does that language make sense here to most of you? The way I understand, the way I was introduced to your community is that you guys are open to everyone, not judgmental. People can come here and ask hard questions. Does that sound about right? And clearly by the setting, you're planting yourself in an open space. There's no steeple on top of a building. There's not even 4 walls, honestly, literally. And let's see, just a couple things just about me. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia, probably the single most segregated church city, maybe outside of South Africa, I don't know, maybe including today, even now, the most segregated black and white church city, maybe, that you'll see on the face of the earth. The first missional community I was a part of, very similar to this, was across the street. My loft in the city was worst part of town, across the street from Ebenezer Baptist Church, if you have any familiarity with the civil rights movement in the U.S. Dr. King was buried and within walking distance of where I'm from. Okay? So all that to say, Winston and I have radically different stories and origins and background, but one thing I'll say is I'm from the part of the world that to this day is probably the only place left where modern, Western, middle-class progressives still genuinely have defensively held on to Christendom, and to church, pre-Christian church culture. Do you follow what I'm saying? The one common denominator that Winston and I have is this. Ancestralism was the religion or the worship that he came up around. Where I come from, we worship Christianity as a culture, in a sense. It sounds crazy, but if you go to America, they call it the Bible Belt, the South. From Texas all the way over to Georgia, where I'm from. From the Bible Belt. So grew up in this setting where I'm not going to give you my story. I'll wait till next week to bore you with that. But I just want you to know that I was part of a community of people that were like you that wanted to desperately to be authentic. But a couple of notes I made that we did, like kind of where I was born out of, the experience I was born out of, started very similar with you guys. But a couple of things happened. One, we grappled with this thing of like, how do you actually be an authentic follower of Jesus and be a modern-day expression of what you read in the early church in the book of Acts. Like, so we wrestled with a couple of things. One, what is this thing called community? It sounds sweet. It sounds cute. It sounds like everyone gets along. and sings Kumbaya. If you've ever read the book of Acts, it seems like everybody's best friends and just alike. The one thing I've discussed with Johan and then last night again with Rudolph for 2 hours is that community is absolutely costly. That's something we found out in our journey in Atlanta. Now, we started off small, but what God did with it is he multiplied it. And that's what I really want to talk to you about next week. It's actually become just a global movement of people just like yourself. You probably don't know about it, but you're actually part of really a global renaissance of people who are reigniting the question and being willing to wrestle with that very issue of what does it look like to truly be community, the community of believers who believe in Yeshua as Messiah, as God. Is anyone tracking with me? I'm from the U.S. You have to like really kind of, amen, brother. Okay, so that's it. I guess we got to go. I want you to realize that you're part of something much bigger than you. People are actually investigating this issue of what is real community, sacrificial community. What is that expressed like in the world today? And I want you to know that God is really, he's into this. I've seen it. So I hope that piques your interest a little bit about next week. See you soon.
Cool. If you don't like what he says, at least he says it in a cool way. So that's cool. And another cool thing about him is he was in prison for 2 years. So he comes here with street cred. And he says he was in jail for the persecution of Christ, but actually he was dealing drugs. It's a bit of an old... But you can... I mean, it's always cool to come and listen to a previous drug dealer. I say previous. I hope it's still... I'm starting to suspect your visit to South Africa. Okay. Daar's koffie buite, daar's nog chips buite. Gesels met die mense, gesels met die vreemdeling. En sien julle volgende week by Zach's Praatjie. Dankie dat julle gekom het.